EU. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery at 1402 South Neal in Champaign, offering guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes, made of pure wool or silk pile. Since 1992, Eastern Rug Gallery has provided cleaning, repair, and restoration of handmade rugs.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. After World War II, chemical companies here in the United States began to aggressively promote the use of synthetic chemicals both as pesticides and as herbicides. And in their advertising, they painted for people a picture of a world free of insects and weeds. However, our guest for this part of Focus 580, historian Pete Daniel, argues that many people, scientists, people in the government, did not consider the long-term impact of these chemicals. In fact, in a book that he's written on the subject, he writes that these folks, many of them, were willing to let the future take care of itself. In this part of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about the lasting legacy of pesticide use after World War II with our guest, Pete Daniel, from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., where he is curator of the Division of the History of Technology and has written a lot about, particularly about the history of the South, and also some about the history of agriculture. He is here visiting the campus to give a talk in the MillerCom series, Marking Earth Week. This is, I believe, the last one for this semester, and that will take place tonight at 7:30 in the Spurlock Museum on the campus. Toxic Drift, the Lasting Legacy of Post-World War II Pesticide Use. That is the title, and it's sponsored in part by the College of Law here at University of Illinois. And we're pleased that he could be here in the studio with us and spend some time talking on the subject. Questions, as always, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you would like to call, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
I'm interested, given the other kinds of things that I know that you have written about, how it is that this particular subject happened to catch your interest.
We were doing some exhibits at the museum, and one of them was on science. And we had a meeting, and they were asking what kind of subjects would be good. And I suggested someone should do something on DDT, since everybody'd heard of it and few people remembered what it was about. So they said, you do it. And then we did that little exhibit and then more in an exhibit called Science and American Life. And by that time, I'd gotten interested from a research angle because I was concerned about a lot I was finding out.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to that time and talk a little bit about the atmosphere of the time and how it was that it seemed that people were so willing to embrace these products and this vision of better living through chemistry that we had at the time, and without, it seems, often without asking very many questions about what the impact of these things might be on human health, on the health of the environment in a larger sense.
Well, after World War II, it became obvious that DDT killed insects very successfully, and that there were other chemicals coming on that also did. And the advertisements were over the top. This is the way you should live, with a weed-free lawn and an insect-free environment, which human people have never had before. And people were never told there were any side effects. There, of course, could not have been any long-range studies of DDT or these other chemicals because they just come on the market. They were used in World War II very successfully. And people were lulled because they thought that all these things had been tested by the government and controlled by the government and therefore were safe. And that was a feeling a lot of people had, and I'm sure some still do, that these things won't hurt me. There was this macho attitude that chemicals, you know, I'm immune to them, they won't hurt me. But people are different in their susceptibilities, and some people can be around chemicals all their lives and not suffer any side effects, just as some people smoke all their lives and live to an old age. But for other people, it's a different story.
Mm-hmm. Certainly there were examples of people in in their occupations who were working with these things, either who were applying them or who were manufacturing them, that got sick. How was that explained, and why is it seems did that not raise more concerns that the effects might be go beyond just an isolated case, that there might be something larger going on?
A lot of poisoning cases happen so in isolated areas, and people didn't put them together. There were crop dusters who crashed because they were spraying organophosphates, and just their nervous system quit and they crashed. And there were other people who were harmed by one thing or another, but there was no real systematic way to keep an account of this. And I think that's why Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, was such a blockbuster, is because she was the first person to put it together. And the book was successful, I think, because a lot of people had questions. They'd maybe known a friend who had a problem with pesticides, or a relative, or had heard some stories about it, but they couldn't put it together. And what Rachel Carson did was to really put these things together in a way that people could have a dialogue and start talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Who in government at this time, and I guess what we're talking about here now would be the late 40s, the 50s, who in government, where in government was the responsibility located to regulate the use of these chemicals?
The Agriculture Research Service handled all these questions. They were in the Department of Agriculture. And they had a responsibility probably the biggest responsibility was in approving labels for chemicals, because there were all kinds of different compounds on the market. They were supposed to have information on what these compounds would do. Most of that information was furnished by the companies that were putting the product on the market. There was very little independent research to prove that these were safe. And then the labels, you had to approve a label. And a lot of corporations did not want a skull and crossbones on their product. And there are lots of stories I wrote about in the book of fighting very hard to prevent that, or to prevent warnings to children and older people. So the labeling process in the Agricultural Research Service was crucial. And I can tell you some stories where when it broke down, it was lethal. When they had a misleading label or an incomplete label.
Well, give us a for example.
Well, an example was a crop duster whose name was Gonzalez, who was a Mexican citizen, who was going to medical school in California, and who was spraying for a crop duster in South Carolina. And he was spraying Folex. This is 1961, as I remember. And Folex, the label had no skull and crossbones, no antidote, but it turned out, an organophosphate base. So on his third run that morning, Mr. Gonzalez was making his, what do they call a swath run, when they go down and actually put the poison down. And he just had stomach cramps. His vision was gone, and basically, that short-circuits your nervous system, and you don't have any more control. And he clipped a wire, flipped over, and the hopper broke open, spilling more on him. And he survived the crash, seriously wounded or injured. And some field workers got the ambulance there, took him to the hospital. And the physician thought he just had a broken leg and all these other physical things. But then he went into shock, and his system was just going down, and there was nothing on the label to tell the doctor what he was dealing with. And he spent hours trying to find out what was going on. And finally, he realized it was organophosphate poisoning, and he gave him atropine, which was the antidote, saved his life. But the man was in the hospital. Gonzalez was in the hospital for months recuperating. His leg never healed properly because they couldn't set it at the time that it should have been, because they were trying to save his life. So he sued the chemical company for a faulty label. And he wanted judgment against them. But 2 years later, when the trial came up, he still was suffering from this accident. And hopefully he went back and got his medical degree, but I never found that out.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Pete Daniel. He's an historian. He is at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., where he is curator of the Division of the History of Technology. And he's written a number of things. He's written histories of the South. He's written about a little bit about the history of agriculture, and a recent book that was just published last year by the Louisiana State University Press that deals with this subject that we're talking about. His title is Toxic Drift: Pesticides and Health in the Post-World War II South. He'll be talking about that very subject today, or tonight, rather, 7:30, as part of the MillerCom series in the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. And all of these talks, they're always free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending can do that. And if you'd like to call in here with a question, you can do that too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about the kind of discussion that went on between the manufacturers of these products and the regulators about this very subject, about what should be on the package, what kind of information should be given to the people who would be handling and using this material.
There were a lot of products that were of marginal safety. And one of these, the example I'll give, is a lindane vaporizer, which was a little cup thing that you put lindane in, and it had a heating coil, and it issued vapors into the air, and it killed insects. The vapors, they would settle on surfaces and on food. And again, most people would probably get along with this okay. But there were cases where the lindane would lead to blood problem, basically fatal. And there was this harrowing story of this young girl in California who'd gone over to a playmate's house, and that house had lindane vaporizers in it, and she got ill. They took her to the physician, and he said that's the only thing that could have done it. And she eventually died. But the companies that put lindane vaporizers out were very reluctant to label those, and they fought for years to prevent any test that would show that it fell out on food. And they would go to the Department of Agriculture and to a part of the Agriculture Research Service and lobby that they didn't want these things changed. And they were really tough. And they had other products that were similar that put off vapors and were dangerous in particular to children and to old people. And they fought ruthlessly to keep that information off the labels. Huh. And the label that I mentioned on the Folex bag with Mr. Gonzalez, how did that get on the market? You have here a lethal compound with organophosphate in it. And at the trial, this man who was an ex-military person, when the people trying to defend the chemical company said, oh, this is not harmful at all. And he said, in his testimony, he said, well, it is harmful. This is what we learn to kill people with in special forces. So, and one of the arguments that was always used by the chemical companies and the defenders was that pesticides are just sort of like automobile things. We have all these deaths on the highway, but nobody's banning automobiles. Well, of course, you drive automobiles. You're licensed to drive. You practice it. And with chemicals, they would just, you don't seek out to get poisoned by chemicals. Mm-hmm. But if they're there, accidents happen and whatever. So there were all these arguments that water's dangerous, aspirin are dangerous. They went all these poor analogies trying to protect chemicals.
It certainly could be argued here that the government failed to protect the health and well-being of some people, if not Americans more generally. When you go to the motivation of the people, say, in the Department of Agriculture, What really was going on here? Was it that they were so concerned that these products were beneficial to agriculture and they believed in this new modern scientific kind of approach to agriculture and they thought, well, these were important tools, we want farmers to have them? I mean, did that override their thinking about the potential harmful effects, or was it the case that they really didn't think that there was such a big problem, and that maybe incidents like the ones you talk about were not that they weren't real, but that they maybe were isolated, maybe they were just the result of intentional or carelessness by the person who was using it, so that it wasn't that they didn't care, but that they really didn't think that it was, that they thought that the benefits of these things outweigh whatever downside there were.
That's a great question, and I've pondered over that a lot, because they really did know these chemicals were dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I first ran into that in the fire ant campaign, where they were using these really powerful chlorinated hydrocarbons, heptachlor, dieldrin, endrin, all these things, and they killed cattle and dogs and all kinds of animals, and they just denied it.
And they were just spraying the stuff from airplanes.
They were spraying the stuff from airplanes indiscriminately over property lines. That is, if you lived in the rural South in the 1950s and early 60s, chances are you were going to get sprayed, because they had the power to cross property lines and spray everywhere. And they produced this film, Fire Ants on Trial, which is a hoot. It's so I showed it to a class when I was teaching a few years ago, and they just were amazed. But it's all these cliches about how safe it is and whatever. And Rachel Carson and some other people were asked to come over to agriculture and view it, and they were horrified and demanded changes, because they claimed that that these chemicals did not harm wildlife. And yet and they even falsified some of the data to try to prove this. So they actually, getting back to your question, they mm-hmm. knew these things were dangerous. They knew they were harmful to wildlife. They knew they were harmful to domestic animals, and to some people complained that they had health problems too. Why they continued to just advocate them, I don't know. There's no, in the public record, there's no sense of remorse or even reflection on that question. So I can't fathom what their thinking was.
We are talking this morning here again with Dr. Pete Daniel from the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. He's curator of the Division of the History of the Technology there, and is here to talk about this subject on the campus. We have a caller here who's been waiting patiently. We'll bring them into the show. And other people who are listening, if you have questions, you can call too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Here we have a caller in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. My first question was one that David asked the guest just before you did this rather lengthy explanation, and thank you very much. The culpability, it's too bad there's statute of limitations is so general. So I asked my second question. It's still along the lines of culpability, but I was wondered, since you've studied this, whether you had any chance to look into other countries' handling of these synthetic things. I'm concerned about whether the sort of the protocol for testing and stuff may have started with in Germany, when the aniline dyes were synthesized and became such an important thing for manufacturing in Germany. This kind of laid back, it's all going to be good, it doesn't harm anything, and then if they have actual data that doesn't say that, there should be some grounds for, you know, prosecution. I mean, I didn't even know about that. You were talking about the child that died from the thing that they were putting on the air to hit the plants and stuff in the South. I'd heard about the planes when I went down to school there, but I never knew of the connection with the children's problem. So thanks a lot. This makes my anger greater, and my perseverance to do something to these people or get them straight on the line that this sort of thing just cannot be accepted in the business world, you know, when the most innocent are at risk. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, you can comment on that however you like.
Well, first of all, I really don't know what other countries did as far as controlling this. In 1970, as I'm sure you know, we went to the Environmental Protection Agency, and most of the duties for controlling and regulating pesticides went there. As far as Germany was going to declare cigarettes a foodstuff, which panicked the Agricultural Research Service and, of course, the cigarette companies, because tobacco has a lot of poison on it. And they didn't know how to solve this problem. And they weren't going to have a German market. And I'm not sure what happened on that. It's just one of the issues I ran across as far as what other countries were doing. But as far as prosecution, it's sad to say that when they investigated the Pesticide Regulation Division, which was part of the Agricultural Research Service in 1969, there was a hearing in L.H. Fountain's committee in the House, and they just found that the Pesticide Regulation Division brought people in from chemical companies with conflicts of interest to work with them, and that they had never brought a case against any offender, although they had all this evidence that people had offended. So they were, I mean, yeah, I share your anger in that nobody was called into task for this. But I don't think now, it's been a while, and I don't think they will be.
Hmm. Well, when the, as you say, when you're going back to the years right after the war, it was the Department of Agriculture that was the regulator. The EPA didn't exist yet. It was a couple decades at least until that happened. And then the Environmental Protection Agency took over the responsibility for the regulating of these things that the Agriculture Department had done. Well, when that happened, did things improve? Has the EPA done a better job?
The EPA has done a better job. I'm not privy to what all they've done, but I'm assured that the regulation now is better than it was under the Pesticide Regulation Division. So I think we're in better hands now. But I haven't studied that. I went up to around 1970 when it went over to EPA. But from what I've heard, I'm assured that we're in better hands now than we were before.
Mm-hmm. What sort of role did colleges and universities where they had big schools of agriculture like this one play in all of this?
Well, some of the land-grant universities in particular had contracts to do work, but some of them were policing this. Auburn University, during the fire ant campaign, they said, "What are you doing? You can't get rid of fire ants. You may control them somewhat, but you're not going to eradicate them." And they were also concerned about the wildlife issues and other things I mentioned earlier. So they had good scientists who were doing their jobs, raising the right questions. I think other land-grant universities may have had other issues. For example, this university was supposed to have done a study on labeling. One had already been done by the University of Wisconsin, and there was supposed to be a follow-up here. And they were trying to figure out if labels were misleading, and everybody knew they were bad. It was small print, big words, incomprehensible contradictions, and some things they said, open all windows before you spray for this. And other ones said, close all the windows on different sides of the label on one product.
It said two different things on the same label.
These came out in the Fountain hearings. They showed these contradictions. So... Hmm.
Is it possible to say that, you know, we talked, for example, about the fact that there were some individual cases of people who were poisoned by their contact with these things and suffered severe health effects of people, even died. To go beyond particular cases where individuals were harmed, can you make an argument that in some larger sense, everyone, virtually everyone, was affected somehow by the fact that these things were widely and in some cases maybe indiscriminately used?
Well, of course, we all have pesticide residues in our bodies. Everybody does. If you break down your blood or whatever, they're pesticide residues. A lot of those are from chlorinated hydrocarbons such as DDT and endrin from the 50s. And whatever else. Some chemicals break down and will go away. Others are persistent. And probably one of the most enduring legacies of this mass spraying, and it was mass, They had control projects for gypsy moths in New England and bark beetles in the Midwest and fire ants in the South. And it was almost like they had to have a program so they could spray the whole country with chlorinated hydrocarbons. Over time, the residue from these things went into the air and water, and the prevailing wind and water currents have swept it up to the Arctic. So today you have polar bears that are not only endangered by the melt, but also they have problems with reproduction, the same way birds did with shells. I mean, there's a reproductive problem mm-hmm. with chlorinated hydrocarbons. And even the women who live in that area, the Indian women who live in that Arctic area, they're almost afraid to nurse their children because of the high load of pesticides in their milk. Mm. And by the way, the whole milk supply of this country had pesticide residues by the early 50s. And that was not announced. So did the meat supply. And so that meant that milk and baby food had pesticide residues as early as the 50s. By the mid-50s, that was the case.
So the federal government knew that and didn't tell people that?
The federal government knew that and didn't tell people about that.
Did they think that that was a problem?
They knew it was a problem.
I mean, not only that it was there, but it was a that there were risks to people's health. I mean, they knew that it was a problem in that respect.
They didn't talk about it in those terms. Mm-hmm. They said we have a problem here. We have a problem because there is pesticide residue in baby food, mm-hmm. and we don't want that to get out. So they kept the lid on it. Now they didn't. They suspected there were health issues, or they wouldn't have been concerned. They could have said, oh, there are no health issues at all here. Just drink your milk with the pesticide residues, and you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. They didn't say that.
And they no doubt they would have been concerned that if that word it would have gotten out, it would have devastated American agriculture.
Yeah, that, and raised some questions about the people who were trying to protect you from pesticide residues.
Hmm. Well, I'm thinking more. I don't know whether it would have started a revolution, but it sure would have cut back on people drinking milk and giving it to their babies. At least that's what I would think.
Yeah, and even some of the field things. There was an investigation up in New York where an organic farm was very concerned because they'd been sprayed. It was part of that DDT spray. Mm-hmm. And ARS, Agriculture Research Service, sent an investigator up there to talk to them. And he said, oh, well, yeah, well, that program's over now. We finished spraying. And you don't have to worry about your organic milk having pesticide residues because it breaks down very quickly when the sun comes out. Well, you know, chlorinated hydrocarbons don't break down. It was going to be residues in that milk. They totally lied to this farm foreman.
We have a couple of other callers here. Why don't we go and talk with them? Maybe I should introduce again the guest for this hour. Dr. Pete Daniel is curator of the Division of the History of Technology at the National Museum of American History, which is part of the Smithsonian. I'm hoping I'm getting all that right. We like long, complicated titles. Am I pretty much got that right?
Pretty much, yeah.
All right. What would be exactly correct?
Well, because we had a reorganization, the division is now the Division of Work and Industry. But that's been fairly recent, so my vita that he's getting his information from is out of date. I'm sorry. I apologize for that.
All right. Well, other than that, the rest sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay. He is the author of a book on this subject that was published by the Louisiana State University Press last year, the title Toxic Drift, Pesticides and Health in the Post-World War II South. And also we'll be talking on this subject as part of the MillerCom series in a talk that's co-sponsored by the College of Law here on the U of I campus. It's in honor of Earth Week. He'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 in the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. Anyone who's interested in attending can stop by. We have some callers here, one on a cell phone calling from Leroy, and we'll go there. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Good afternoon, Dr. Daniel. Daniel, thank you for taking my call. Let's fast forward, if we can, to today, and could you speak to the political culpability in the current climate? Given that the Food and Drug Administration was established to protect us from bad food and poorly made drugs, that the Agriculture Department was created to market agricultural product around the world and hopefully help the farmer, and those things have turned into essentially organs of the corporate industries that they were originally designed to regulate. Speak to that in a contemporary context, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Is that something you feel like you can do?
Well, I really don't feel like I can give an adequate answer to that because I'm a historian and my knowledge of current events is from the newspapers and my knowledge of the past is from reading through the records of the people who were doing these things. And in the time I studied from World War II to 1970, the companies were very much in charge of making decisions in the regulatory agencies. They put enormous pressure to have their way. And, of course, as the caller suggested, I'm sure that's true today.
Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What sort of connections do you see between the way people thought about these issues then? Maybe this, I don't know if you could answer the question or not, but because there are still, we're still wrestling with some of the same kinds of issues. Products that seem to have potential benefit, that also have potential downside. How do we make the decision whether we're going to use them or not? And it seems in so many cases that what we do is we dwell on the benefits and don't think too much about the downsides until later. You know, new things come along. We tend to be fairly enthusiastic early adapters. And then afterwards, we start asking questions about whether those technologies are good or not.
Well, we've got the cart before the horse. That is, the product shouldn't be on the market until they're tested and found to be benign. But when you come up with something, for example, people have concerns about genetically engineered food, there's no way we can know what long-term effects are. We can be assured and whatever, but because we've been misled before, we always have these lurking questions in our minds. Like, what's the real down-the-road effect of these things? And even with nanotechnology now, they say there are some problems that could be coming up from that. But there's this rush to market products before we really know whether they'll be safe or not. And that is something that has been with us, I'm sure, before World War II, but it's certainly documented since World War II, like with these pesticides. You know, the prudent thing would have been to say we won't put any pesticide on the market until we are assured that it's either benign or that we have a control system so that it won't get out and be a danger to people. But instead, they marketed the product, and once it's on the market, it's very difficult then to go back through and take it off. And the people who were supposed to do that weren't interested in doing that anyway. So you run into this real problem of the cart before the horse. You should assure the public, make sure these products are benign and not a health threat.
Yeah. Well, it seems that has been a problem for a long time, that some people think that the manufacturers of the products should be incumbent upon them to demonstrate that the products are safe. And instead, we sort of say, they can say, we can demonstrate to you that they're not harmful. And in fact, those two things are actually two different things. In the face of it, it might seem that that was the same thing. But actually, we're talking about two different things. We still really don't put the onus on your manufacturer to say, before we'll let you market this product, you must prove that this is a safe product. And yet, as you say, still today, we really don't. That's not the approach that we take.
And not only that, but as occurred back in these days, the people who provided, and corporations did supply a certain amount of evidence that this product was safe, but that was their data. And as you know, in any trial, when you have expert witnesses on both sides of the question, or you have independent scientists doing something as opposed to those sponsored by a corporate study, there have been recent articles on that, how the corporate studies always seem to find the corporations' products fine. So it's not just one thing. It's just a whole lot of issues that come into this.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, since your background is in the sort of in the history of technology or whatever you want to call it, whether there are any examples of some kind of new or emerging technology where there was this general consensus that said, before we do this, before we go there, let's make sure, to the best that we can, that there's no problems with it. Has that ever happened?
I don't know. I think that people say they've done that in a lot of different things. But when you go back into the records I've been into, you realize that that wasn't true, that the things were, they didn't know what these chemicals were going to do. And in the case of organophosphates, which I haven't talked very much about, there were horrible accidents with that because it's so lethal. And there was a crop duster wrote an amazing autobiography, Bill Robinette, sprayed out in New Mexico and Arizona. And he said that there was no bad job with parathion. He said it kills horses, it kills snakes, it kills rabbits, it kills everything. And he gave this harrowing story of a man who was walking through the field on his way home one afternoon, and that field had been sprayed by parathion, and he went home and died in the night. Because what happens is the parathion just short-circuits your nervous system. And there's a lot of technical things you could say about it, but basically your nerves quit connecting, mm-hmm. and you stop breathing, and you die. So those kind of products were lethal, and yet they were used. And even Bill Robinette told this harrowing story about his own experience with it. He'd spill some on his flight suit one day, and he admitted foolishly he didn't go wash it off, and went up to fly. And fortunately, he got back down, but he kept getting sicker and sicker. And he said that one morning he went out and it was really, he should never have been in the airplane. He got back and he was supposed to go back out that afternoon. And fortunately, the wind was too high and he couldn't go out. And his brother found him and he was just incoherent. Mm-hmm. And they gave him atropine, but he still had 2 or 3 days before he could get back.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of curious to note that I just recently talked with someone who had written a history of chemical warfare. Some of the most modern chemical weapons that we have were developed, the first generations of them were developed in Germany in World War II, and what they started out looking for was pesticides. They were trying to, because they couldn't import the chemicals, they needed them for their agriculture, so they decided, well, we've got to develop our own. And they came across these chemicals, and they were so powerful that, yes, not only would they kill insects, they would kill everything. And this came to the attention of the War Department in Germany and said, oh, wait a minute, maybe we ought to have those. And then they went on and developed them as anti-personnel weapons. But what they were starting out looking for was, they were just looking for pesticides to replace those that they used to import and they couldn't get anymore.
There's a sort of opposite side of that in World War I, where we developed chemicals. And after the war, of course, there was no market again. So the Chemical Warfare Service basically wanted to continue development and got into pesticides and started, they had surplus planes and crop dusting started in the early 20s. And this was a way to continue research on chemicals. And there's a wonderful book by Ed Russell, War and Nature, that mm-hmm. I highly recommend to the listeners.
Let's talk with some more folks here. Let's go to Champagne next, line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm very sensitive to the human health and safety issues raised by pesticides or, for that matter, prescription drugs or whatever. But if you look at the regulatory regime now, say under FIFRA, the federal insecticide pesticide law, it's an unreasonable risk regulatory regime. And that is, to make a determination as to unreasonable risk, you weigh burden against benefits. And even though there may be a risk with pesticides, if the benefits of the pesticides to the economy or to the population or whatever outweighs the risk, then that pesticide will be approved by the EPA. And, of course, a major problem here is the source of the information sometimes comes from the manufacturer of the pesticides, who is supposed to be, in theory, regulated by the EPA. And the same holds true with prescription drugs. Prescription drugs are to be approved by the FDA if they are safe and effective, and they are safe if the benefits of the prescription drug outweigh the risk. Again, doing those clinical studies, the information is derived from the person or the entity that wants that approval. So we have a situation where we got to be risk takers, And if the benefits generally are derived from information provided by the regulee indicates they outweigh the risk, then we're going to be stuck with these in a regimen that is not going to give us an optimal level of safety. It's going to give us a cost-effective or reasonable level of safety, and that's a part of the problem as I see it. Another part of the problem in terms of pesticides and food production is a part of the American consumer psyche. We want perfectly looking consumer products, vegetables, fruits, and things of that nature, and we want them to be cheap because we are addicted to cheap goods. And for that to happen, pesticides are going to be involved in the mix, in my estimation. So I think sometime we have to look at ourselves and say what Pogo said, we've arrived and the enemy is us.
Excellent points. You want to respond? No?
Well, I agree with the caller's points. Risk benefit suggests that someone will be sacrificed. And the majority of people will be fine, but there will be people who are sacrificed for this. And I've never agreed with that philosophy because I think, as the scientists tell us, they can do anything. So why can't they make products that don't kill people? And I'll just stop there. Maybe we have another caller.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and we appreciate the comments. Well, but I think also that you have to appreciate the – particularly at the time that we're talking about, if we're talking about the late 40s and the early 50s, the kind of faith that people had in science. And I don't think that it was the case that people thought science was perfect. I think people were willing to admit the possibility that science could make mistakes. But there was also this belief that any problem science created, science could fix. Sure, one scientist, you know, maybe he'd do something that would create a problem. But then some other scientist would come along and find some way to take care of that problem. So we thought that it was something that could indeed solve any problems that it would create.
Now, there's a lot of hubris among scientists, and I think you're exactly right, that it was just over and over. We can solve any problem, and any problem that comes up, we can solve it. And a more realistic approach would have been that we're going to have problems and we're going to have to work and solve them before they get out of control. But that wasn't an issue.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm calling on a cell phone.
Oh.
So I just wanted to make sure you could hear me.
Oh, yes, I hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I heard you say something about a chemical called parathion, and it made me remember another chemical similar to that, I think. It was named malathion.
Right.
And back in the 70s, it was available, and we used it around our place for fly control and different things. And I wondered if you could tell me something about malathion. Is it as terrible and awful as parathion?
Well, it's the same type of organophosphate that parathion is.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to your garden store today and look on the product labels, you'll see that malathion is a main ingredient of a lot of chemicals that you can buy.
Oh.
And if you use it as directed, it shouldn't be a problem. That is, it's an effective insecticide that unless you get so much of it, it's probably not going to harm you. The other side of that is parathion and malathion in a concentrated form, if you get some on your skin, you'd better wash it off because it's lethal. But hopefully the regulations today are sufficient to guard us from that.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to relate a story then regarding that because whilst I was using that around the house, I was also pregnant. And the baby that was eventually born had horrific problems and eventually died shortly after birth. He was blind and had heart problems, lung problems, and was malformed in a number of ways, and we couldn't figure out why, and the doctors were like, oh, you know, we don't know.
It's always...
So I mentioned the malathion, and they said, well, that's probably not it, you know, so it's always been in the back of my mind that maybe that had something to do with
Well,
that baby had.
It's so difficult to determine what causes things like that because, for example, Radiation Act 30 years later, some of the pesticide things, some of the chemicals would too. It's very difficult to determine exactly where some of these things we have today come from. And but in your case, I'm not a physician, so I couldn't say,
no,
but it's certainly a concern.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just wondering about that, and I never got any satisfactory answer about malathion per se, you know, as whether it had any, you know, effect on people as far as gestation and, you know, infant development, stuff like that, so... That's what I'd ask you. Thanks.
There's a website, by the way, you can go on where it tells you the effects of chemicals. And I'm not sure if you can find that by just putting in malathion and getting that website or whether there'll be some other way to get it. But there is information.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have a few minutes left here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Pete Daniel. He's curator of the Division of Work and Industry at the National Museum of American History at Smithsonian, Washington. He's here visiting the campus and talk about this subject. And he's written a book, one of the number of books that he's written. This one in particular deals with this subject. It's titled Toxic Drift, Pesticides and Health in the Post-World War II South, published by the Louisiana State University Press last year. And he has written quite a bit, one way or another, about the history of the South, his special kind of interest. Questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Another caller here. This is someone in Urbana, line one.
Hi, yeah. I was really moved by the question that the woman, your earlier caller, posed. And I was struck by something in your response to her. It seems to me that as a historian of science and technology, I mean, one of your jobs should be exactly to point out the shortcomings of scientific rationality and reasoning. I mean, that's exactly the problem in proving culpability today, that there is no control group, that this all of this stuff is in our blood, in our fatty tissues. We, you know, no matter how clean you live, your baby is already born with a healthy dose of dioxin and DDT and PCB residues. And I think this is exactly that kind of complex web of chemicals that lets the chemical industry off the hook. And if you read Our Stolen Future, that's exactly the point they make, that we ought to come up with a totally new scientific rationality where the standards of proof are going to be different than your classical cause and effect standard of proof. And so I was just wondering if you have come across anything in your research that points to the inadequacy of this classical scientific reasoning. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you completely about having better standards of proof, but I haven't run across any change in the ideology of put it on the market first and then let's see how it works out later. And that's one of the great flaws in the thinking we have, in my opinion, about products that are marketed, is that we're willing to put a miracle, apparently miracle, compound, chemical, any product on the market, and everybody laps it up, and we don't know what the long-term effects are. We just have to go along with the best judgment we can find or not purchase the product or take whatever action the individual feels, but there's certainly no explanation of what kind of risk we're taking.
All right, let's go to someone in Indiana, Edwardsport, Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. The caller, not the just the caller before, but the one before that with the problem with the baby. I was raised down in the Florida Keys and during the mid-60s, and they used to spray for mosquitoes with crop dusters, and then they had a truck that would come around. And it seemed like there was a lot of miscarriages from humans, and the cats would only have one kitten. And I wondered if there was any correlation to that.
I could only guess at the correlation, but DDT has a problem, causes problems with reproduction, and that's been proven. especially with birds. We almost lost the eagles and the pelicans and so forth because of the residues in their bodies would produce thin-shelled eggs, and when they would sit on the nest, the eggs would collapse and they couldn't reproduce. The other part, I've not studied it. As far as humans or cats or whatever, I just don't know the literature on that, but mainly because, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a historian and I tried to find out about the past, and I've probably been negligent, not understanding enough about the present. But these are real concerns that I think everybody should owe it to themselves to read more and find out more about the present.
Well, this was back in the 60s.
Yeah. But
sure they don't use the same chemicals anymore.
Right. They don't use the chlorinated hydrocarbons anymore because they found out that there were grave problems with those. So by the 70s, I think most of those were phased out.
Okay. Well, I was just curious because I didn't know of any studies done that, but it just seemed like that people around there were talking about that a lot.
Well, I wish somebody would do some research on it and put together a demographic study to show what was going on.
Okay, well, thank you for taking my call.
All right, thanks for the call. Go to Urbana real quick here, line two. Hello.
Hello. Just what you said about only being a historian probably couldn't answer my question, but I'm 60 years old, and when I was about 5 years old, my brother and I were crop tested, and we got terribly sick, lost control of our body functions and everything for a few days. Never went to the doctor back then, but I just wondered I was trying to find out if there was any long-term effect on that kind of thing. We didn't know. I didn't remember being crop dusted because I was so little, but my brother said so. Plus, we lived out in the country in the woods, and we would fog our houses with the black flag, which was DDT. So there's probably a lot of people like me, and I was just kind of wondering if you had any idea about what happened to us and what the effects were at long range. I mean, I'm still here.
I'm sorry to say we're also real short on time here.
Okay. Usually there are no long-term effects on most people. There are certain people who are susceptible in ways, and you probably wouldn't be here at 60 years old if you were one of those people. I think that's about the best answer I can give.
My apologies to the caller. We're just going to have to stop because we are here at the end of the time. But again, for people who are here in and around